Please sit comfortably. Good morning, everybody. I feel as if, compared to the wonderful Tay show that the cicadas are giving us this morning, anything that I say is going to be totally redundant. But anyway, it's my job, so I will. This morning I'd like to take up a haiku by Issa. And some of you may know this this poem already. This dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, and yet... This is one of Issa's most famous poems, written following the death of his daughter, Sato, just after her first birthday. In Japanese, it's particularly lovely. So let me try to give you a sort of sense of that if I can. As you probably already know, traditional Japanese haiku consists of three lines. The first line has five syllables, the second line has seven syllables, and the third line has five syllables. So in Japan, it's tsuyu no yo wa, tsuyu no yo nagara, sari nagara. And that feel of the da 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 da. It's a form which is right through Japanese poetry. There are lots of other forms of poetry that take that 7+5 form. So the first short five-syllable line consists of the words tsuyu no yo wa. Tsuyu no yo means the world of dew, or as it's more poetically translated, the dewdrop world. And the grammatical particle wa at the end of the line marks what comes after, what comes before it rather, is the main topic of the sentence. So that's why we get this dewdrop world. In the second seven syllable line, tsuyu no yo, the dewdrop world, is repeated and followed by nagara, which means while or although, giving us while it's a dewdrop world. So together they mean this dewdrop world, while it's a dewdrop world. And the statement is completed in the fifth, in the third short five-syllable line, sari nagara, which means, and yet, this dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, and yet. Before reflecting on the haiku, let me say a few words about the person who wrote it. Kobayashi Issa. To give him his full name. Issa was born Kobayashi Yataro. Kobayashi is the family name and Yataro is his childhood name. He was born in 1763 and he died in 1828. In Japan, he's one of the most valued of all haiku poets. He wrote more than 20,000 haiku during his life. Several of which are included in a collection that Aitken Roshi published towards the end of his life, entitled The River of Heaven, the Haiku of Basho, Buson, Issa, and Shiki. In this collection, which actually came out in 2011, 1 year after his death, Roshi translates and adds commentary to about 170 of the 20,000 haiku. There's also a lovely book of translations of Issa's poem called Inch by Inch, in which a number of poems, not including the one that we're considering today, are translated by the modern Japanese poet, Nanao Sakaki. And in this book, I actually meant to bring the book and then I left it at home. Both the original Japanese and the English are presented in Sakaki's own handwriting. So it's quite a beautiful book. And then the Japanese pronunciation is printed in Roman script at the bottom of each page. Isa's family was devoted to the Pure Land, or the Jodo Shinshu, a school of Buddhism. And Isa eventually ordained as a lay priest in this school, taking the name by which he's generally known, Isa, which means simply one cup of tea. In an interview, Nanao Sakaki, speaking in English, contrasted the farmer, Isa, with that other great haiku poet, the samurai, Basho. He said, "Isa's more peasant, good for peasant, like middle class because he's a landowner, but only a very small patch. Still, he was a landowner, so landowner means middle class. Basho, mostly intellectual background. Isa, nothing, no education. He learnt only from his life. So that is more closer to everybody." And there is a part of what people really love in Isa is the incredible simplicity and sort of humility of his poems. Sometimes it's almost as if he's not there at all. Although his family was a moderately well-off landowning family, Sakaki is very small patch, probably overstates it a little bit. Isa had a difficult life. His mother died when he was 3, and after his father remarried and his grandmother died, he was so miserable that at the age of 13, he left home and went to live in Edo, which is what's modern Tokyo now. He married in 1791 and fathered 3 children, 2 of whom only lived a month, and the third, his daughter Sato, died just after her first birthday. As I said earlier, the haiku we're focusing on today was written on the occasion of the death of Sato. So what are we to make of this dewdrop world, this but a dewdrop world, and yet? Eiken Roshi, somewhat surprisingly, makes a great deal of Isa's pure land beliefs about the dead going to the pure land after death. I'm not inclined to take that tack myself. Apart from anything else, what I've been reading recently about Pure Land Buddhism suggests that while there's undoubtedly a strong emphasis on being reborn in the Pure Land of Amida Buddha, often through reciting the name over and over again, at a deep level, it also recognizes that the Pure Land is right here and now. And Hakuin presents the Zen view of this when he says in his Zong of Zazen, which we chanted this morning, "Even those with proud attainments wipe away immeasurable crimes. Where are all the dark paths then? The pure land itself is not far." Actually, the old translation, the translation what used of that used to be, "The pure land itself is near." And later, "Boundless and free is the sky of samadhi, bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly is anything lacking now. Nirvana is here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha." What the poem says to me is, even though you may see clearly into the insubstantiality of things, the dewdrop nature of the world, the dewdrop nature of the self, there's still sadness. On the face of it, this might seem to contradict the promise held out in the opening lines of the Heart Sutra, which we also chanted this morning, which is perhaps the most fundamental and universally known of all the Buddhist texts in Japan. Would have been just as well known, if not better known, by Isa than by us. My paraphrase of the opening of the Heart Sutra goes like this: "When the Bodhisattva of compassion, you call her Avalokiteshvara or Kannan or Guanyin. When the Bodhisattva of compassion practices the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, she clearly sees that the five aggregates of form, sensation, perception, mental reaction, and awareness are all empty and without any abiding substance. Like a dewdrop, you might say. And in this way, she transcends all suffering. But we have to be careful here. It's very attractive to think that realization, crossing to the other shore, and Prajnaparamita actually contains an implication of taking you across to the other shore, that this will somehow magically and for all time free you entirely from any sadness and suffering. It's seductive to think that, but you sort of have to realize that statement at the beginning of the Heart Sutra is sort of ideal in some ways, and it's complex, and doesn't mean quite what it seems to mean at first. The Zen tradition reminds us again and again that our actual lives as they're lived are complex and often messy. And I ask you, would it be appropriate not to feel pain at the loss of a beloved young baby daughter? All things are essentially empty, and that realization undoubtedly liberates us from suffering. But how do we apply this in our lives as we actually live it, moment by moment, day by day? One of my favourite Zen poems, which we encounter in the Denkwodoku, or the record of the transmission of the light, is Keizan's poem appended to the end of Case 6. Denkwodoku is a collection of enlightenment stories that were compiled by Keizan Jokin, and again we recited his name in our first sutra dedication this morning. They were compiled in order to establish a lineage for the Soto school in Japan. Keizan was a grandson in the Dharma of the great Zen teacher Dogen Kigen, and he lived between 1268 and 1325. In the Diamond Sangha, in our school, as it were, we take up the Denkwodoku and this poem quite late in our koan study. And the poem goes like this. I'll wait for the other poem. Though we find clear waters raging to the vast blue sky of autumn, how can it compare with the hazy moon on a spring night? Most people want to have it pure white, but sweep as you will, you cannot empty the mind. For me, there's a deep affinity between this dewdrop world as but a dewdrop world, and yet, and most people want it pure white, but sweep as you will, you cannot empty the mind. And it's interesting to consider what Keizan's commenting on here. Here's what Case 6 says. The fifth patriarch, Daitaku Sonja, told Mishaka the following teaching of the Buddha. If you practice the supernatural or study the lesser way, it is as though you are bound by a rope. You must know yourself. You must turn from the lesser streams and at once enter the great ocean. Then you will surely attain realization of no birth. Hearing this, Mishaka was enlightened. Why do you think does Keizan, in this context, want to warn us about wanting everything to be pure white and to encourage us to embrace the image of the hazy moon, the hazy moon of and yet? Another expression of and yet occurs in the Women Guan Case 38. Wuzhu's buffalo passes through the window. The case goes like this. Wuzhu said, It is like a buffalo that passes through a latticed window. Its head, horns, and four legs all pass through. Why can't its tail pass through as well? And the poem, passing through, falling in a ditch. Turning beyond, all is lost. This tiny little tail, what a wonderful thing it is. Why is it wonderful, this tiny little tail? This tiny little tail of and yet. Because it's what makes us human. How without our joys, our sorrows, our frustrations, our terrors, could we ever develop true wisdom? How could compassion mature in our hearts? Our way is the way of the Bodhisattva, which embraces everything, which grapples in the mud without ideas of purity. Ideas about nirvana as somehow pure and of Buddhas as being those who have passed across into the world of the unconstructed for all eternity are attractive and inspiring ideas. But that's all they are. They're ideas. Where is it? Right now. Even the fact of realization can become problematic. So you're entirely swept away by the sound of the cicadas. Everything disappears. Great. Congratulations. And I'm serious. Congratulations. That's wonderful. But the point is, what are you going to do with this realization? How are you going to integrate it into your life as it's actually lived? At this point, I want to move away from the reflection on poems and koans and sutras to some more personal experiences. Because the little tail that doesn't pass through the latticed window is nothing if not personal and based in actual experience. You'll often be asked in Doksan to make your response to a koan point more personal. And when we say personal here, we don't mean please entangle us in your stories about yourself. Rather, we want to see the koan alive and embodied by the one that's sitting on your cushion. When our good friend and Dharma companion, Gordon Waters, Gordon painted this painting which is now hanging up here at the very end of his life. When he was dying, I sometimes went across to his house to sit zazen with him in his studio. We'd sit there facing each other, just breathing, just sitting. It was a great privilege to be able to sit with Gordon like this, and it rather brought me down to earth. After all, Gordon was actually going to die, and soon. One by one, each of his sense gates, his sight, his hearing, his smell, his taste, his touch, and his thinking mind, if we're going to shut down. What would be left then? Emptiness and form may be one, as the Heart Sutra reminds us, but when form ceases to exist, when dharmas cease to arise, what then? Sabana told me that when he was dying, Sexton Burke, I guess not all of you know who Sexton is, but he was one of the teachers in our Australian Sangha. He taught in, now I've gone completely blank on where he taught,
Bellingen?
Yes, Bellingen. Thank you. Yeah, he taught in Bellingen. And when he was dying, he said, the only reason that people fear death is because they think that there's somebody to die. Yes, true, if we fully realize that there is nobody here at all, that there truly is no self, then we need not fear death. But as we will see, that requires considerable maturity. Gordon told me that he wasn't particularly concerned about death itself, about dying. And he wasn't particularly concerned about the process of dying. He had complete faith in his palliative team. But he told me that he couldn't bear the thought of leaving all those people who were dear to him. His wife Anna, his family, his friends, of whom there were an astonishing number, as we learnt when we went to his funeral. And at that stage there was little that I could say to comfort him. Patrick Carney, who's a Theravadan teacher who teaches around here sometimes in Sydney, recently told me another story about Sexton, who said something quite similar to what Gordon said when he was dying. That is, that it wasn't the dying that concerned him, but what would happen to his wife and children after he died. According to Patrick, when he said this, the venerable Vipassana teacher, Christopher Titmus, said, "But Sexton, surely you can see that this is just a view." And then, according to Patrick, Sexton palpably relaxed, as if a great burden had been lifted from his shoulders. Now, because I'm not, I haven't been brought up in the Theravadan tradition, I didn't really understand what view meant in this context. So I questioned Patrick a little bit more. And he replied to me, he actually wrote me an email on Friday. And this is what he said. View, or ditti in Pali, is a cognitive understanding. In this case, that is, in the case of Sexton, it's a cognitive understanding of an affective state. You could say that it entails the meaning of the affective state. So, for example, the body might be churned up and disturbed, and the mind needs to understand what that means. So it could read the sensations, the body, the first aggregate, and the associated feeling tone, the second aggregate, as pleasantness or unpleasantness, as, oh my God, a disaster's just happened, or it could happen. And this interpretation is cognitive and in the realm of meaning. And this is where we find view. But of course the same sensation and feeling tone could be interpreted as, wow, that was fun, and the experience would be read in it or interpreted or seen very differently. So much of meditation training actually consists of learning to read, interpret one's own experience according to the categories of Dharma, that is, within a Buddhist framework, and to place reality there rather than in the categories of self and other. But in both cases, it's just an interpretation. I know that's probably quite dense if you're not used to the Theravadan world and the way that it talks about dealing with different aspects of experience within the framework of the Dharma, rather than using it as something which gives rise to a sense of self and other. It's quite difficult to understand that. But let me try and make a little bit of sense of how I take that as applying to the exchange that happened between Sexton and Christopher Titmus. What I think happened was that Christopher drew Sexton's attention to the fact that his anxieties were simply feelings that arose naturally as a result of conditions. That is, from the fact that he was dying. There was no need to make a story about them, and there was no need to allow them to become a locus for the generation of the self. This is quite important in terms of the and yet in our poem. When you really pay attention to it, this and yet is very subtle. It only hints at feeling, and it also seems to convey a deep acceptance. But it doesn't name the feeling. I named the feeling as sadness. The poem doesn't name the feeling. And it doesn't create any stories around them. I created the stories. I told you the context of the poem and all that. But the poem itself doesn't create that. So it doesn't really name it. It doesn't, and it doesn't create stories around it. There's no sort of self-pitying self in that poem. You know, the world is the dewdrop world is a dewdrop world. But and yet. You know, there's something very pure about the feeling there. No stories, no naming, just that expression of sadness. So at the risk of creating a story about myself, let me tell you about a recent and unexpected brush with death that I had. I was driving to a weekend walking retreat in the foothills of the Southern Alps of New Zealand with my friend and fellow teacher, Arthur Wells. Arthur had picked me up from the airport, and we were barreling along one of those long straight roads that you get on the Canterbury Plain. At one point, we were behind a car approaching an intersection. The car in front pulled over to the left as if he was going to turn left at the intersection. And then, just as we were about to pass him, he turned right and swung right into us. We collided with the car at high speed, and our car took off diagonally across the intersection, straight towards a concrete power pole. I felt completely calm, but the thought arose in my mind, oh, it's going to end here in New Zealand. And there was a sense of this being almost appropriate, self-evident almost, that I would die in the country that I was born in. Somehow, but Arthur maintained enough control for us to narrowly miss the power pole. We ploughed through a ditch and demolished a fence and ended up about 40 metres into a field. And thankfully, once the car stopped, we were able to open the doors and get out. The first thing that struck me was the total insubstantiality, the dewdrop quality, you might say, of everything. The vivid, unique green of the hills, the vibrant presence of the distant mountains, the caress of the cool late afternoon breeze. Another thought arose. What if we were dead? How would I know? And back came the answer. I can't say. There's an old Chinese story from the Blue Cliff Record. Dawu and Jianyuan went to a house to express condolences. Jianyuan rapped on the coffin and said, "Living or dead?" Dawu said, "I won't say living and I won't say dead." Jianyuan said, "Why won't you say?" Dawu said, "I won't say, I won't say." On the way home, Jianyuan said, "Your Reverence, please tell me right away. If you don't, I'll hit you." Dawu says, "If you like, I'll allow you to hit me, but I'll never say." Jianyuan hit him. Later, after Dawu had passed away, Jianyuan went to see Shishuan and told him this story. Shishuan said, "Alive, I won't say. Dead, I won't say." Jianyuan said, "Why won't you say?" Shishuang said, "I won't say, I won't say." And with these words, Jianyuan was enlightened. No sooner had I had this thought of, I can't say. If you ask me whether I'm alive or dead, how would I know? I can't say. Then I was immediately engulfed in a profound surge of grief. Oh, the pain that would have been unleashed if Arthur and I had died. And images of my grieving loved ones flooded into my mind. And then a couple of weeks later, after I got home, I had a terrible dream in which I'd been abandoned by everyone that I loved. And this was another late appearing manifestation of that surge of grief that I felt just after the accident. And I suddenly understood how Gordon must have felt. Although when you die, you're the one that's leaving, you're also the one that's losing everything. So, the thing is, the arising of feelings like this are unavoidable. They arise from circumstances. To imagine the grief of my loved ones, to feel abandoned when I thought about dying, these are, like Issa's, and yet natural and appropriate. The important thing is how we regard them and how we work with them. And although I've just, for the purposes of teaching, turned this whole thing into a story, let's just put that aside. If we can avoid turning them into stories about ourselves, then we will have taken a step, and an important step, on the path of liberation. This dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, and yet,